Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. Cast of Hamilton, but the Beastie Boys get our first sounds today on the Brian Lehrer Show. We will get to the act of Hamilton speaking back to Donald Trump's worldview when Mike Pence went to see the show on Friday night. But there was also this, since we last spoke, swastikas and the words "Go Trump" were drawn on playground equipment at Adam Yorch Park in Brooklyn Heights, prompting a demonstration by Brooklynites that included many elected officials and Ad Rock Horovitz from the Beastie Boys, Adam Yorch's group. And NYPD Commissioner James O'Neill had already said, yes, hate crimes are on the rise in the city.
There has been a lot of rhetoric, but this is New York City, and we're much better than that, and we won't tolerate these crimes. We have the best hate crime investigators in the United States of America. So if you're going to engage in behavior like this, rest assured that you'll be arrested as quickly as possible, and we'll work with our prosecutors to make sure that you're fully prosecuted under the hate crime statutes.
So let's start right out with our first guest after Commissioner O'Neill, and it is Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, on the daunting job of representing New York State and New York values in the Senate in the coming age of Donald Trump. Senator, we appreciate you coming on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. I'm delighted to be on.
And can I start by asking what you would say first to New Yorkers who are afraid after what happened in Brooklyn Heights as just one example, NYPD commissioner saying what he said there. Reince Priebus went on television yesterday and said aspects of Islam itself, not just groups like ISIS, are problematic. A KKK chapter in North Carolina is planning a victory rally next month because Trump was elected. This is much more than the game of politics right now for so many people in our diverse state, as I know you know.
Well, the first thing I would say to your listeners is to not be afraid. This is something we will overcome. This is not who we are as a country. I will speak out. We should all speak out. We will win this, and we will push back hate in our country, in our state. And it is horrible what's happening, Brian, around the state. I'm headed to upstate New York tomorrow to Buffalo, where we've seen hate crimes in Buffalo. We've seen hate crimes in Rochester. We've seen hate crimes across upstate New York. We've seen swastikas. We've seen KKK. It's very alarming. But for listeners, we do not need to be afraid of this. We are going to fight and push back, and we are going to show who we are as a nation, regardless of who the president is and regardless of who he appoints. We are going to show what this country is made of, and that's standing up for what we believe in.
It's going around social media that you're encouraging people to call your office for a concerned citizens tally about Trump appointee Steve Bannon, because of his empowerment of white nationalist and misogynistic hate speech when he ran Breitbart News. Are you doing something like that?
Well, we've received a lot of calls, and I want my constituents to continue to call me, to reach out, to tell me what their priorities are. And I got to tell you, we've had hundreds of calls, and I've written each caller a personal letter that we – not only do I share their concerns about – all of the hate that's going around the state, but I have concerns about some of these appointments, and we do have to speak out on them. But I can tell you, Brian, things are changing, and I do believe this is a wake-up call for all New Yorkers and all those who care about human rights and civil rights and fighting against all signs of hate, whether it's anti-Semitic, whether it's bigoted, whether it's racist, whether it's sexist, whether it's anti-LGBT. And so we have to use our voices, and we have to use our voices in all places, and we have to demand the respect and the kind of country that this country was founded on.
How? And I read that there there's something that you would do with this tally, if there is a tally, once you have it, some kind of additional statement that you would make that's somehow more formal than what you just said.
Well, I plan to do a speech tomorrow in Rochester, and I'm going to talk about how many constituents I've heard about. But for me, my relationship with the constituents in the state, I represent them, and I want to hear from them because not only does it empower me to speak louder, stronger, more forcefully on the issues they care about, but then I can talk about what's happening in my state. Because sometimes my colleagues here, you know, they're from different places. They don't necessarily aren't in tune with what's happening around the country. And so when I can use real examples of how people are afraid and what's going on in their lives. I mean, I had a call from a woman who was in the grocery store with her daughter, and she had a headscarf on, and she was being literally intimidated and harassed in the grocery store. You know, threatening remarks from other shoppers. I mean, that's not acceptable. And so we have to, I want to use those examples and use them so that our leaders and President-elect Trump and those he appoints can understand they have a role here. They have to protect the rights of these citizens and really push back on maybe their view of the world and that they don't see this as an issue.
And listeners, your questions are welcome for Senator Gillibrand at 212-433-WNYC. 433-9692 on how to represent New York in the Senate in the age of Donald Trump and a Republican Congress, by the way. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. The website Bustle says you've already called on Trump to fire Bannon. Have you done that?
Yes. In fact, I immediately tweeted that I thought there was no place in the White House for someone who is leading the alt-right movement. And I'm very concerned about anyone who is known to or believed to promote bigotry, racism, sexism, anti-Semitism, and anti-Muslim sentiments. And so I just, you know, we don't have a role in confirming Bannon or not, but I do think people need to hold him accountable, and that means speaking out and being aggressive and watching what he does in that role.
Bannon did an interview with The Hollywood Reporter the other day and said a few things maybe intended to assuage people's fears or clarify his positions on some things. He said he's not a white nationalist, he's an economic nationalist. And he said, quote, like Andrew Jackson's populism, we're going to build an entirely new political movement. It's everything related to jobs. The conservatives are going to go crazy. I'm the guy pushing a $1 trillion infrastructure plan. With negative interest rates through the world, it's the greatest opportunity to rebuild everywhere. So how do you take all that? Is Bannon and therefore Trump more complicated than some want to give them credit for?
Well, we don't know, but what I do know, if he believes in rebuilding our economy, I'm going to keep his feet to the fire on passing a national paid leave program and make sure he cares about things that affect structural reform, whether it's equal pay for equal work or affordable daycare or universal pre-K, so that everyone in the workplace can reach their full economic potential. So if he's open to creating economic growth, then I'm going to give him a lot of good ideas about how to do that.
Senator Schumer, who of course will not just be your fellow senator from New York, but the Senate Democratic leader, was on some of the Sunday talk shows yesterday and seemed very willing to work with Trump. I want to play a soundbite of Senator Schumer with Chris Wallace on Fox News Sunday.
On, surprisingly, on several different issues, Donald Trump and his campaign echoed the views of Democrats, not Republicans. Massive transportation bill, trade, getting rid of the carried interest loophole, cleaning up the swamp. And on those issues where he agrees with us and the Republican establishment and hard right doesn't, we challenge him, work with us, and keep your promises to blue-collar America. I think blue-collar America voted for Donald Trump more on Democratic issues than on Republican issues, which he professed. And we will work with him on those issues.
Rework NAFTA?
Absolutely.
Kill the Pacific Trade Partnership, which seems like
it's gone already, but I'm glad it is. I opposed it.
Paid maternity leave.
We should work out something that's strong and good, but I'm open to it.
After which, Chris Wallace said, kumbaya, Senator Schumer on Fox News Sunday. So, Senator Gillibrand, are you on the same page in terms of working with Trump as hard as you can on places where his agenda is in sync with the Democrats?
Well, I'm skeptical of Trump, and I think he needs to do a lot more to extend a hand to the rest of the nation before he deserves the benefit of the doubt. He did mention things in his campaign that I'm interested in pursuing, but his plans at the time weren't very good. So, for example, his daughter gave a very strong speech about the importance of a national paid leave program, but the actual proposal was only for women. So that's not adequate. You need to have a gender-neutral plan that addresses all families for all family events. So that's the kind of thing, yes, he said it, but I don't know what he meant. And so I'm not sure how to handle that. And when he appoints people like Bannon, you have an enormous question in your mind. Does he mean that he really does want to work on these things together? So I'm skeptical, but I will, of course, try. And when he tries to subvert any rights that we have fought our lives for, whether it's women's rights or LGBT rights or civil rights, we will fight very hard. And I'm prepared to fight tooth and nail on these things.
You know, there's concern in some progressive circles about trying to compartmentalize like that. They say Trump is such a potential threat to women and Muslims and people of color that Democrats shouldn't normalize him. You've heard that word, normalize, by making deals on normal policy items like infrastructure or NAFTA or maternity leave or parental leave, because it'll grow his power to do white and male nationalist things. The only moral or politically adequate response is to refuse to do business with him starting today, the argument goes. Have you seriously considered that option, thought about it?
Well, I agree that we cannot normalize him and where he has stated his goals. I mean, he is so far outside the mainstream on so many issues. And so I think the instincts of many of folks I've talked to over the last week and a half, we have to be vigilant. And his racism, his anti-Semitism, his sexism, the things that he exudes in various statements, that cannot be normalized. And we have to fight like hell on those issues specifically. Now, if he does want to work on a paid leave plan and lets me write the bill, that's a very different scenario. But we cannot give an inch on these basic civil rights and human rights. We cannot. And when he says things that are racist, sexist, or homophobic, we have to bring down an enormous hammer because it's not acceptable. And it's not acceptable for the president-elect and our future president to talk that way or to have policies that reflect that kind of worldview. And that's why every time he nominates someone who we are concerned about because they either have racist statements in their past or anti-Semitic statements in their past, it creates alarm bells for all of us because we have no place to trust him that he's going to work in a reasonable way. And so that's why fundamentally I'm skeptical. I'm not optimistic that this will work out for any of us. And I think it's going to be a very long haul of fighting and protesting and speaking out and demanding our rights and not creating an environment where we let things slide.
Did you say on paid paternal leave or parental leave, if he lets you write the bill?
Yeah, my bill's great. If he wants to support it, it's a good thing. It would make a huge difference for America.
Has he reached out to you at all?
No, he's not reached out to me. I wouldn't expect it, but we'll see.
Ahmed in Clifton, you're on WNYC with Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. Hello, Ahmed.
Hi, good morning. Good morning, Senator. My question is this. To the extent that some of the more onerous things that Trump is proposing are within the purview of the executive, such as the Muslim ban, I'm a Muslim. You know, I read Korematsu yesterday very, very studiously, and, you know, there's nothing.
That's for people who don't know, that's the Supreme Court decision that legitimized the internment of Japanese people during the Second World War. Go ahead, Ahmed.
Which, Brian, as you're aware, was never overturned. Justice Scalia said, if you think that's not going to happen again, you're kidding yourself. I mean, what really can the legislative branch do? What can we do if these things are, you know, enacted by the executive? That's really my question, my concern.
Well, I'll fight him with every ounce of my being, and I will ask my colleagues to do the same. I will ask Americans to rise up against such hateful policies, and we have to fight. This is if he literally does those things, then it is the beginning of a very long war, because honestly, that is not tolerable in this country, and we should not allow it, and we should never stop talking about it, and it should flood the airwaves so that nothing else can be done.
I know that one of your, and Ahmed, thank you, I know that one of your big issues in the Senate has been fighting sexual assault with proposals for improving how it's handled in the military and on campus. Did you feel betrayed in some sense that so many Americans were willing to not see the Access Hollywood tape as disqualifying in that respect?
Well, certainly I saw it as disqualifying. Someone who's bragging about sexually assaulting women should really never be elected to be president of the United States. But I do think it created awareness, and I think we now have an opportunity to move the ball forward. I think a lot of people were very disgusted and offended, and I think that hopefully can move a larger conversation on how to reform both the Department of Defense and the Department of Education. We have big concerns about the Office of Civil Rights at the Department of Education, and we have to do much harder work to not only reform that work, but to make sure Trump doesn't give ground on what already has been accomplished. I mean, we've been working on ending sexual violence on college campuses on a bipartisan basis for the past 4 years. And if he undermines that work, it will be devastating for these students who are trying to survive and get an education and live productive lives. So I don't know the effect of what those statements had on the electorate. I don't know why more people didn't find it disqualifying. I'm not an analyst or a pundit to tell you that answer. But I know it created a national conversation that I'm now going to continue, and we are going to talk about why it's not okay to brag about sexually assaulting women and why it is not locker room talk, that it is actually criminal behavior. And so it gives us at least a reference point to have a much more forceful conversation about what's acceptable and what's not.
So here's maybe the next piece of the conversation that the nation is about to have. Senator Jeff Sessions has been nominated as Attorney General, and I wonder if you're familiar with what he said to the conservative Weekly Standard magazine after the Access Hollywood tape came out. Quote, "This was very improper language," and he's acknowledged that. He said, talking about Trump, but the reporter followed up, "But beyond the language, would you characterize the behavior described in that as sexual assault if that behavior actually took place?" Sessions said, "I don't characterize that as sexual assault." The reporter said, "So if you grab a woman by the genitals, that's not sexual assault?" And Sessions said, "I don't know. It's not clear that how that would occur," unquote. And then, you probably know this, after that interview was published, Sessions released a statement that said, "My hesitation was based solely on confusion of the contents of the 2005 tape and the hypothetical posed by the reporter, which was asked in a chaotic post-debate environment. I regret that it resulted in an inaccurate article that misrepresented my views. Of course, it is crystal clear that assault is unacceptable. I would never intentionally suggest otherwise." But when he said assault is unacceptable, I would never intentionally suggest otherwise, even then, Sessions did not say that particular behavior is sexual assault, according to him. So I'm embarrassed to even be saying these things in a question. But as a leader on this issue, how will this inform your assessment of whether to vote for confirmation?
Well, I have very grave concerns about Senator Sessions as the head of the Department of Justice. And I will, of course, pay attention to his hearings, and I, of course, will give him the opportunity to speak out about what kind of head of the department he's going to be. But I have to say, those comments are so offensive and so dangerous. And if he doesn't understand the basics of what sexual assault is, I don't know how he can be attorney general. Because honestly, that's one of the attorney general's jobs. The attorney general of the Department of Justice has to focus on a lot of these cases. In fact, whether you're talking about the military, the DOJ has jurisdiction in cases where you have dual jurisdiction. and in, like both military and civilian. And in fact, the DOJ has to help the Office of Civil Rights for the Department of Education on these cases. So he has a real role, and if he doesn't understand the basic tenets of what a sexual assault is, I don't think he has the background and knowledge that he will need to be Attorney General.
Mike in Hell's Kitchen, you're on WNYC with Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. Hi, Mike.
Hi, good morning, Brian. Good morning, Senator. Thanks for taking my call. So I really appreciate Senator's articulation with the frustration the rest of the country has for the president-elect. I wanted to ask the senator, how does she feel about the institutionalized cronyism that has really transcended both parties? I feel like the Democratic Party in particular is really disconnected with the people on the ground. We have had countless officials indicted, including Democratic officials. Sorry, I'm getting a little nervous. And I wanted to know how the senator would deal with institutionalized cronyism that really removes the legislators from the people that they represent.
Well, I have to say, Well, I have to say that I very strongly share your concerns. We've seen huge problems around the country in our own state. I think what Donald Trump's doing with nepotism is very, very problematic, especially given that his family have financial entanglements on the meetings he's been taking. I mean, it's really very concerning that we have a president who's bringing family members who have business interests into meetings that are government meetings, that are about government, about whether it's trade, about whether it's national security. It's wrong, and it has to change. And by the time he's sworn in, he better sort that out, because it's not acceptable, and it's a violation of the law. So I share your worries. We need, you know, at the end of the day.
But his worries weren't just about Trump. He was asking about the Democratic Party as well as the Republican Party, and, you know, this feeling on the part of a lot of voters that one of the reasons they chose Trump was to, quote unquote, drain the swamp.
We do need to drain the swamp, and I got to tell you, Washington is broken, and too many people are not here for the right reasons, and that's beyond cronyism. But in terms of my job here in the Senate, one of the first bills I passed was, and you won't believe this was actually the law, but members of Congress were immune from insider trading. They actually were allowed to take non-public information, trade on it, and make money. And so I worked with Susan Collins and others to pass the Stock Act, which bans it, and as a way to begin to do more ethics reform here in the U.S. Senate. But I share the caller's concerns. I mean, we have too many headlines around the state, and it's very frustrating. We need accountability. We need transparency. We also need a new generation of people to run for office. We need more transparency, and we need more people. And that's one of the reasons why I founded my Political Action Committee off the sidelines, to actually ask more people to run, get more diversity, ask more women to run. And so I try, and my role is just to lead by example as best I can. I publish my taxes online. I publish my financial disclosure online. I have this thing called the Sunlight Report, where I post all my public meetings online, so that, for example, if I'm meeting with an interest group that you hate or don't like, you can not only call up and say, you know, if they got a meeting, I need a meeting. And I think that's a good lens for people to be able to look through, to say, I will have my chance to speak my mind. So that's what I try to do. But I share your worries and concerns. We do need better leaders. We need more young people to go into government. And fundamentally, we need to get money out of politics. The biggest thing I could accomplish in my lifetime is get money out of politics. If we could have publicly funded elections, both statewide and federally, I promise you it would change outcomes. Because a lot of good people that I wish were running for office don't run because they hate the negative ads, they hate the nasty playing field, and they say, I would never do that to my family, so they don't run. It's one of the main reasons women don't run for office. And if you could get all that money out of politics, you would have less negative ads. You would have less millions of dollars going in by corporations that are entirely non-disclosed. So let's just say a candidate doesn't a company doesn't like a candidate's pro-environment stance. They might run millions of dollars of negative ads and never tell people, oh, and by the way, we're from the oil industry and we just don't like her pro-environment stance, but we're going to crush her and run these negative ads because we don't want her elected. That happens all the time. So it's a big problem, but we need a better players list, and we need more diversity, and we need money out of politics, and we need more transparency and accountability, and that's the kind of work I'm going to do where I am to try to change that feeling that you have that the best among us are not in public service.
I know you got to go in a minute. Some people are already naming you as the next first woman president. Do you see yourself as a potential candidate in 2020?
No, I am very focused on running for the Senate in 2018, and I really value and appreciate what I get to do as a U.S. Senator. I feel like it is a blessing that I get to serve and speak out on these issues, and so I'm going to do that.
New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Brian. Thanks for having me on.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We continue. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. What some call political correctness has been a criticism against the left from conservatives for quite a while. Democrats often dismiss the right's disdain for, quote, PC culture as insensitive, retro, and sometimes even bigoted. But since the Democrats' defeat in November, some within the Democratic Party have come to blame political correctness and the left's focus on identity politics in particular as a reason why Hillary Clinton lost. Just yesterday, Bernie Sanders, asked by a questioner how she could become the second Latina senator in U.S. history, Sanders replied that a candidate's gender or race isn't enough. He said, according to transcripts, "I have to know whether that Latina is going to stand up with the working class. It's not good enough for someone to say, I'm a woman, vote for me. No, that's not good enough." Adding, "One of the struggles that you're going to be seeing in the Democratic Party is whether we go beyond identity politics," unquote, from Bernie Sanders. Now, over the weekend, Mark Lilla's essay in the New York Times became the number one shared piece from the Times website. It's called "The End of Identity Liberalism." Mark Lilla, professor of the humanities at Columbia University, also a visiting scholar at the Russell Sage Foundation, was just on the program recently for his new book, "The Shipwrecked Mind on Political Reaction." And he joins me now to talk about this essay and the response to it. And with us with a response is George Yancey, professor of philosophy at Emory University and author of "Look, a White: Philosophical Essays on Whiteness." So, Professor Lilla, welcome back. Professor Yancey, welcome back to WNYC. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Thank you.
So, Mark Lilla, you say that while celebrating diversity is a splendid principle of moral pedagogy, it's disastrous as a foundation for democratic politics. What makes it disastrous?
Well, what makes it disastrous is that it doesn't provide a narrative to the country as a whole, a narrative that especially will attract people in the vast middle of this country, both geographically and in every other sense, economically, and religiously. The focus on our differences has taken our eye off the ball. We need to absorb the fact that Donald Trump, of all people, is now the president of the United States. It's not just a question of the Electoral College. Liberalism has lost its grip on the national narrative that is now owned by Republicans, and it's protected by a truth filter that's been established by Fox News and by conservative radio hosts. If we're going to get serious again about actually winning, even a dirty victory as opposed to a morally pure victory, We must find a way to get our act together, our message together, to get past that filter and to reach people in the middle of the country who will respond to it and see that we're speaking about their concerns.
But in terms of identity politics, what does that mean? Not embracing the Black Lives Matter movement, not embracing gay marriage as a principle for the Constitution. How do you be inclusive in the way that the Democrats, you know, believe their values to be reflected by without engaging in some of this just because the politics around the issues often breaks down on identity lines in real life?
I don't think it does. I think when we – by identity, we mean something special. We mean someone's self-definition. It's self-referential. It's not persuasive. It's expressive. When we defend Black motorists who are being stopped by policemen unfairly, who are being treated roughly, who are being shot, we are standing up for a principle of the law. And we can convince people that we need to convince people that this is a principle and, two, that it should apply to everyone. The same goes for the harassment of gays and lesbians and transgender people in this country, that they deserve the protection of the laws. And so if we stress the principle and the fact that the principle covers all of us, that it's our common property, we can both defend people who need defending and get on board people who are in fact in favor of these principles.
But then take me one more step before we bring in Dr. Yancey for a response. Where's the line? Because I would imagine that Hillary Clinton, as the case in point here, would say she was defending precisely those principles, and therefore it was how she talked about what amount to Black issues or gay issues or pick your group.
Well, no. In her rhetoric, what she often did at every stop, and she was persuaded to do this by the people in her campaign, that it would be enough just to get out the vote in various groups, is to call out to particular groups, to African Americans, to LGBT community, to women. And these are vast portions of the country. Women are the majority in this country. But to even use that language is to sound in the ears of people who are in the Fox News bubble that we have to reach exclusionary. And when you speak of principles as such, you're able to pierce through that. You know, it's a question of narrative, but it's also a question of public sentiment. Someone sent me a sentence from Abraham Lincoln, one of his speeches. He said, "Public sentiment is everything. With it, nothing can fail. Without it, nothing succeeds. He who molds public sentiment goes deeper than he who enacts statutes." We need to reach people where they are, where their sentiments are, and to get them on our side.
Dr. Yancey, what would you like to reply to first?
Yeah, a few things. There's a lot in the piece that I disagree with, but I appreciate Mark for writing the piece. That's very important in terms of opening up dialogue. But just take the Black Lives Movement for an example. It's not just that the Black Lives Matter movement is self-referential. It is certainly that, to the extent that Black people have suffered for hundreds of years in this country. So really, the Black Lives Matter movement is about a human movement. And actually, if one thinks about the Black Lives Movement, it's possible to say that Black Lives Matter, while at the same time saying that all lives matter. In fact, embedded in the Black Lives Matter movement is the universal that all lives matter. But whenever you have individuals saying white lives matter, it does not logically follow, nor has it historically followed, that all lives matter. So the idea that Black Lives Matter is a kind of identificatory politics, I think, is to say that it's exclusively that is deeply problematic. But I would agree with Mark that, I mean, I would argue that Clinton did, in fact, she missed a certain opportunity in a certain demographic, namely the white struggling and suffering working class. But Trump precisely played, I think, what Mark is calling a kind of identity liberalism by appealing not only just to class,
But to whiteness, what I'd say is a structural binary. It wasn't as if, you know, working class whites heard Trump's message about anti-establishment and thought he's our guy, right? Rather, they also heard his racist xenophobic narrative, which is precisely an identificatory narrative. So if you want the psychology of this, then, I mean, it seems to me that it's not just about working class, it's about the way in which the white working class felt the sting of a kind of lack of recognition, precisely not only because of their working class, but because they're part of the white racist vanguard. So it's that reaction of not just suffering under class, but also the sense in which they have been left out of a certain kind of white narrative. So I would argue that undergirding Marx's piece is that it's not that we ought to engage in a post-identity politics or in a post-identity liberalism, but that we ought to critique whiteness, which has always been a structural identity politics.
Mark, go ahead.
Well, to begin with, as I say in my piece, Black Lives Matter has given a lesson to the conscience of all America. I mean, there's been some acting out as well, but I agree entirely. I mean, on this score, the only reason Black Lives Matter is that all lives matter. If all lives don't matter, then Black lives don't matter, right? But there's a difference there's a difference between saying all lives matter and white lives matter, which is what was suggested, and that's absolutely right.
Yeah, but you know, all lives matter. Yeah, sorry, all lives matter is actually a kind of universal that Black people cannot existentially afford to speak. They have to say Black Lives Matter because it's their lives that aren't mattering. And embedded, I'm arguing, within Black Lives Matter discourse is the language of the universal, because when you are the wretched of the earth, embedded.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, but I'm just saying that the Black Lives Matter discourse is already a universal claim, you see, because when you're the damned of the earth, when you're the least of these, when you say that my life matters, you already mean that all lives matter. So it's the failure of America to respect Black life. That is the problem. It's not the failure that we fail to recognize all lives matter. It's the denigration of Black bodies in America.
Well, this is true. The problem is there, but it is not – you're talking about an implicit message. That is not explicit to people. That is not the way some people are reading it. It's the way I read it. It's the way I read it, but not other people. Let me give you an example. You know, there's this now famous Saturday Night Live skit that was sort of a Jeopardy show, and there were three Black actors on the panel, and the moderator is Black, and you have Tom Hanks dressed as a good old boy, and there's some questions are asked, and what develops in the skit is that, in fact, Tom Hanks's concerns are also the concerns of the Black people on the panel, that they agree about economic things, they agree that they've been ignored by an elite and all the rest. And then the last question in the skit is fill in the blank, X lives matter. And all four of the Black actors look at the white man who kind of stumbles and says, well, I kind of think all lives matter, and they turn away.
Yeah, and of course the problem with that – yeah, go ahead.
Now, if you followed – how that went down on Fox News and conservative media, you know you have a problem. And if you want to win and not just score a moral victory, but win, you've got to pay attention to that.
George, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, sure. Actually, I saw that Tom Hanks. I saw the Saturday Night Live piece. The problem, of course, is that Tom Hanks, after the show, and I'm not even meaning Tom Hanks, but his character, can theoretically leave that show and go out and not be killed because he's showing his wallet, right, that doesn't get translated into a gun. So, I mean, still there's a ways in which his white privilege carries him outside of that show. That is to say, the character. But the problem is, like, in your piece, for an example, you argue that liberals should bear in mind that the first identity movement in American politics was the KKK, which still exists. Those who play the identity card should be prepared to lose it. I mean, that's false. It's not the case that the KKK was the first movement in American politics. I mean, if you think about Bacon's Rebellion in 1676, that was all about whiteness. If you think about, by 1691, Virginia had already passed laws that said that if a white woman were to marry someone who's a Negro or an Indian who's a Latino, or who's mulatto, she would be kicked out of the Dominion of Virginia. So already you have a white politics of identity in this country, right? So prior to that, so your advocation for a kind of post-identity liberalism, and if by that you only mean that certain groups should not be excluded or placed under erasure, then you and I can agree with that. But the problem is that the problem is not inherent with identificatory politics. When black people and people of color and disabled people and queer people and people who are of Muslim orientation, when they're arguing about their identities, it's not as if they're playing some identity card. They're saying, recognize our humanity. And the problem with Trump is his victory was not because he had some greater ethical universalism. His victory was predicated precisely on a discourse of xenophobia, racism, and sexism, which is precisely playing into an identity politics. So if you're going to remind us to go beyond a kind of identity liberalism, then we have to critique Trump as well and institute a kind of, let's call it a humanity identity, if anything, right? But it seems to me seems to me that the discourse that propelled Trump forward, it was not simply because you had these poor whites who were struggling, which we all ought to empathize with and sympathize with. It's not just that. They didn't, like, bring out a metric and said, oh, yeah, we're being missed out on because we're the poor working class or the working class. They bought into Trump's racism and his xenophobia. That's why Trump won.
Well, to begin with, I think you overestimate the role of that in his election vastly. But nonetheless, on the other points you're making about the condition of black America, racism in America, by Ku Klux Klan, I meant a self-conscious movement outside of government initially with a whole metaphysics of whiteness.
But the metaphysics of whiteness had preceded that. That's the problem.
Right, but it was not – well, in any case, it was not distilled into a movement that had the effect. But nonetheless, let's say we agree about all of that. I'm trying to get you and other liberals to focus on the fact that
–
well, fine.
I'm a humanitarian.
Fine. Whoever, non-Trump voters. I want to convince non-Trump elite voters and opinion makers that we lost. We have lost since 1980. The narrative of the country has been taken. It's not just a question of the presidency. More than 30 governorships are Republican. More than 30 state legislatures are Republican. In 24 states, we have both a Republican governor and a Republican legislature. If we can't go out and start winning back state legislatures and governorships in places where the gerrymandering goes on, where the unwillingness to apply civil rights legislation to defend black motorists goes on, where a blind eye is turned to LGBT people, if we can't go on and capture those governments, this is just talk. We have to win, period.
I'm really enjoying listening to the two of you have this discourse. And I hate to even jump in because this is at a high level. But we only have a few minutes. And I want to throw one other thing out there for both of you, just because you're both college professors. And if you're just joining us, Mark Lilla from Columbia and George Yancey from Emory on Mark Lilla's widely shared op-ed in the New York Times, saying that too much identity politics contributed to Hillary Clinton losing the White House and contributes to Democrats losing a lot of races these days. The idea of PC culture, quote unquote, is often most associated with college campuses. And I'm wondering if you can just both talk a little bit about how you encounter it at your school as a professor, and if you think it's changed and become either, you know, more constructive for society by flourishing again, I think, in recent years, or more destructive. Mark, I know that you've said that education is in part to blame for the rise of PC culture. So you want to go first?
Yeah, well, I mean, my experience in university is that this seems to come in 25-year waves. I mean, in the 60s and the early 90s and then now, it must have something to do with intellectual generations. I'm not sure. But in my day-to-day work, you know, I just deal with my students and I don't get involved in university politics, though. A law professor at Columbia published an article in the Los Angeles Review of Books yesterday, calling me a white nationalist and comparing me to David Duke for my article. So that's the reality. That's the reality on a number of campuses. But the problem there are two problems with PC on campus. One is it is simply handing a weapon for Fox News and Republicans to beat us with. If you're worried, if you're getting worked up about your pronouns and your Halloween costumes, how is that going to be read in the rest of the country? You need a sense of proportion. But the problem with PC is that it encourages in young people something they already have, which is narcissism. As young people, they're naturally narcissistic. Social media makes them more narcissistic. And their idea of politics is to begin with their identity and to spend a lot of time thinking about what it is, and then to become political to the degree that it affects the identity the way they've defined it, rather than thinking about an analysis of society as a whole, which Marxism provided one version of that, and a picture of where we go and how society works, and about reaching an entire country and fighting to be able to govern it for what you believe
in. But are you two just talking past each other in the way that you're talking as a political strategist who deep down believes in liberalism, whatever that is, and George is talking about his notions of reality as it exists? Does your notion of reality not conform with his, or just your sense of what's going to win elections and not alienate Fox News viewers?
Well, good question.
No, actually, I think George and I probably agree on a lot of things about what's, you know, we may disagree about how to talk about it, but agree about what's going on out there. What I haven't heard from him, I'd be interested to hear, is what's your plan? What is your plan for actually taking back the nation and capturing the national narrative?
Yeah. Can I speak now?
Please.
Yeah, I don't think that's incumbent upon me. I don't think I need to answer that question, quite frankly. You wrote the article, and I appreciate your having written it. But I want to say first, I think it's not that there was too much identity liberalism that led to Hillary Clinton's not winning. I just think that it was too much white identificatory politics that led to Trump's win. And I also want to say that I think you and I do differ in terms of our pedagogical orientation. I mean, in my classes, I teach courses called Critical Whiteness Studies, Critical Philosophy of Race, and African-American Politics, right? I mean, African-American Philosophy. So you might say, identity is all in there, right? But no, what it is, it's an attempt to critique powers and structures that exist in American society. And it's an attempt to communicate with people who are black, who are people of color, who are disabled. I took a course where I was just floored because I kept using, talk about pronouns, I kept using the wrong terms to describe individual people. So I didn't use the term transgender correctly. I didn't use the term cisgender correctly. Now, those issues are extraordinarily important. They are existentially important for people's identity. So I think that, Mark, part of your problem is that you think this is an either-or situation or disjunct. We can do two things. We can talk about the ways in which identities suffer, the way in which black people, people of color, disabled, cisgender, you name all those categories, transgender, the way in which they have to suffer every day of their lives, while at the same time making an appeal to a certain kind of universalism that is much more inclusive. So in my pedagogical practices, I practice what's called paideia, or what's called bildung, right? These ideas, it's about education as a form of educare, as a form of moving out. So implicit in that, in fact, explicit in that form of pedagogy, is the universal. So it's not that, I think that the idea that you're working with is a false dichotomy. That dichotomy doesn't have to exist at all in terms of the way in which one approaches one's, the way in which one engages one's critical pedagogy. In fact, I would even want to do away with the language of PC. That language is already deeply problematic. Why don't we just talk about the ways in which all of us as human beings, particularly within the United States, suffer across various axes. And so if you want my take on this, my sort of what's next, right? I think that we need a beloved community which then speaks higher to the politics of Clinton and also higher, certainly higher, to the politics of Trump. I think that we need a kind of radicalization of a certain kind of humanism in the United States that we have not seen. And part of that humanism will involve a critique of whiteness, which I see as the core side of hegemony within this country.
And you know what? The clock determines, as probably does the state of humanity, that we will not solve all of philosophy and politics in this conversation, and we're going to have to leave it here. So I really appreciate both of you engaging. Mark Lilla, professor of the humanities at Columbia University, who wrote the essay, The End of Identity Liberalism, in this Sunday's New York Times that's been so shared online. He's also the author of The Shipwrecked Mind on Political Reaction, and George Yancey, professor of philosophy at Emory University and author of Look, a White, Philosophical Essays on Whiteness. Thank you both so much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks, George.
Brian Lehrer.
Yeah, thank you, Mark.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More in a minute. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. How will the Trump presidency affect reproductive rights for abortion and even contraception? It's not at all clear how issues of access and cost will play out. Trump has said he will nominate pro-life judges to the Supreme Court and that he wants to repeal and replace Obamacare, which fully covers birth control. One social media meme that maybe you've seen or shared is for women to get IUDs now while they're still covered by insurance, IUDs because they last for years. Here with me now to talk about what could happen and answer your questions on reproductive rights in the era of Trump is Elise Hoag, the president of NARAL Pro-Choice America, the organization dedicated to expanding and protecting reproductive freedom. Elise, welcome back to WNYC. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Well, it's great to be here. I wish it was under better circumstances.
Yes. I saw you personally quoted as personally veering between disbelief, fear, denial, and anger. I guess you wrote that in Cosmopolitan. But you also wrote, the fight for our values isn't won or lost in a single election. And a president doesn't make reproductive rights decisions on his own. So what's your biggest fear?
I mean, you know, my biggest fear is that we adjust very quickly to what is considered a new normal, where, you know, we saw this during the campaign where Donald Trump used shock and awe to sort of take the bar so low in terms of what we believed was offensive or something we should examine coming out of somebody actually running to be our commander-in-chief. And I think we're going to start to see that move not only into the rhetorical realm but the policy realm. And so, you know, I have big concerns. I have big concerns about the nominations to the Supreme Court. I have big concerns that when Congress comes back in session on January 6th, that the first thing that they vote on vis-a-vis Obamacare is to remove the contraception mandate, which has made contraception so much more widely available to women all over this country. I have great fear that they will actually ban abortion after 20 weeks as soon as possible. But really, my overarching fear is that we start to see these as small things when they are anything but, because they are happening so regularly and wrapped in such extreme rhetoric that we just adjust to what we call the new normal.
Listeners, we can take a few questions for Elise Hoag, president of NARAL Pro-Choice America, 212-433-WNYC. Everybody's wondering, is Donald Trump, the president, going to be different from Donald Trump, the candidate? And he gave an indication of that already on the question of reproductive rights. I'm going to play a 55-second clip of Trump with Leslie Stahl from 60 Minutes on Sunday.
Will you appoint, are you looking to appoint a justice who wants to overturn Roe v. Wade?
Look, here's what's going to happen. I'm pro-life. The judges will be pro-life. They'll be.
But what about overturning
this law? There are a couple of things. They'll be pro-life. They'll be in terms of the whole gun situation. We know the Second Amendment, and everybody's talking about the Second Amendment, and they're trying to dice it up and change it. They're going to be very pro-Second Amendment. But having to do with abortion, what it, if it ever were overturned, it would go back to the states. So
but
it would go back to the
some
states.
Some women
and the states
won't be able to get an abortion.
No, it'll go back to the states.
By state? No, some.
Yeah. Well, they'll perhaps have to go to they'll have to go to another state.
And that's okay.
Well, we'll see what happens. It's got a long way to go, just so you understand. That has a long, long way to go.
I know what you want to react to there, I think. It's so she'll have to go to another state.
I mean, you know, I think that Donald Trump is actually – the way that he's framing this is super interesting, right? Because he actually knows what we know to be true, which is it may be the extreme anti-choice movement that helped get him elected, but the vast majority of people who voted for him actually did not vote for him to make abortion more difficult to access. We live in a majority pro-choice country where even people who say, you know what, I probably would never do that myself, still don't think the government should be making that decision or making it more difficult and thereby more dangerous for women who need to access abortion services. So he's trying to play it both ways. I think that what we need to recognize, and this sort of goes to what you were saying earlier about the role of the president, is Donald Trump just, you know, assume the presidency at a time where the extreme anti-choice movement is seeing the sort of penultimate achievement of 30 years of work that they've done to take over state legislatures. So if it were to go back to the states, we would immediately see abortion almost impossible to get in many, many states around the country. So what I think we're talking about is a very small number of asylum spaces in the country, and what we all know, which is that women with means will be able to travel to those states, and women without means will find a different way to do what women have always done when they don't want to be pregnant, and they are. And we have to remember that that is already happening around the country. In Texas, where, you know, the clinic access was drying up for years and years. A research study found that 12% of women in the Rio Grande Valley, these are poor women, these are women without access to travel, were attempting to self-abort before they could reach a clinic. We saw this under Mike Pence in Indiana, where a young immigrant woman named Purvi Patel attempted a home abortion and was actually sentenced to 20 years in prison for it. So this is not a theoretical. We actually know what happens when women are not able to access the kind of care that they need. It's not pretty, and it always, always affects poor women, disproportionately women of color, immigrant women, more than it affects the people that Trump is trying to pacify who voted for him.
I realize that there could be several openings on the Supreme Court over the next 4 years, because of how many aged Supreme Court justices there are. But are you reassured about the solidity of Roe based on the decision that the court made this term, that rather than weaken Roe, it used Roe as the basis to throw out the Texas abortion law, where, you know, the particular restrictions on what doctors had to do and what clinics had to do were seen as violating a woman's constitutional basic right to choose under the laws as the Supreme Court had interpreted in the 1970s. So does that give you faith that, and I don't remember if Scalia was still alive and on
no,
the court.
Scalia heard the case, but was not there. No, Scalia did not hear the case. I'm sorry, God, it feels like so long ago, doesn't it? It was one of the first big cases that happened after he passed away, and then obviously was not a part of the decision.
But it wasn't a 4-4 tie, right?
No, it was certainly not, and it is helpful, right? What that victory showed was, I always say it was a victory. I'm a Texan. I'm from Texas. Uh-huh. So it was a victory for Texas. It was victory for women around the country. But it was a victory for evidence-based decision-making. What the court found was that there was no way to justify these clinic regulations under the name of women's health, and the primary purpose of these clinics is women's health, so that they were artificial, imposed on the clinics in an effort to actually shut them down, and could not be justified under the incentive for making the law in the first place. So that's good, right? It is good. We want the court actually looking at evidence and making decisions that way. I think it's anyone's guess what kind of case the anti-choice movement would bring to overturn Roe, but it certainly wouldn't be a similar case to what we called the trap laws in the whole women's health case that we did win, because it would go to the very core constitutionality of the right to terminate a pregnancy. And there are all different legal ways to do that. I'm not a lawyer. I don't even play one on TV. I'm good friends with lawyers who work in the movement. But what I will tell you is that the anti-choice movement has been pretty savvy in bringing cases in the past. So we have to keep a very, very clear eye on it. And while we do appreciate the current court for their evidence-based decision-making, there may not be a lot of parallels between that case and the case that they would bring to overturn Roe.
Lori in Washington Heights, you're on WNYC with Elise Hoag. Hi, Lori.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for taking the call. What I wanted to say is that, you know, going along with the idea that this is not theoretical, after a lifetime of research, I discovered that my maternal grandmother died of an illegal abortion. My mother grew up without her mother, without her siblings, because they were dispersed amongst relatives, and it just totally destroyed this working family because a poor woman had no alternative, you know, other than to seek, you know, not good care. And it was all kept secret, and I am just so fearful, and I take this issue so personally, because we cannot go back to that time. Women deserve to have access to health care. That's the bottom line. And I just cannot, I find it difficult living in a country that doesn't understand the importance of that.
Yeah, I mean, Lori brings up so many good points illustrated by her personal family history, and we hear about stories like this all of the time. I mean, I think one of the most important points she brings up is that, we live in some sort of academic fantasy world so often in the political debate in this country, where we talk about reproductive freedom as though it's separate from economic security, when the reality is the ability to safely and with dignity determine how and when and with whom you have a family has everything to do with your ability to finish school, to do your job, to keep your job, to take care of the family you have. It's important to remember 6 in 10 women who seek abortion care are already mothers trying to take care of the families that they have, and that when abortion is more difficult to get, it doesn't drive the number of abortions down. It just drives the number of consequences up, which has a resonant effect on these families and the livelihoods. The other point that Lori is making that I think is really important for your listeners to understand is that this is, you know, abortion is a medical procedure. It is one that women will seek regardless of what the laws are. What we really need to be talking about in the political context is why we have a set of people running for office who actually don't trust women, don't have enough respect for women to believe that we should be in command of our own medical decisions and by proxy our own lives, right? And I always say this is not really a fight about abortion, because if it was, Mike Pence and Donald Trump would join hands with us and fight for greater access to contraception and fight for the kinds of policies that support, you know, working moms who are already struggling to make ends meet, but they don't do any of that. They fight those things too. And so what it is a fight about women's place in society, whether we believe that we should be equals with dignity, trusted to make our own decisions, or whether in Mike Pence's and Donald Trump's worldview, we're there to be controlled, we're there to be preyed upon sexually, or told what to do when it comes to childbearing. And, you know, I just don't think that the majority of Americans actually believe women can't make our own decisions.
Tara in Harlem, you're on WNYC with Elise Hoag, president of NARAL Pro-Choice America. Hi, Tara.
Hi. I'm calling because I heard your guest saying that she's horrified that if a pregnancy went beyond 20 weeks, that would end. And I'm pro-choice. I'm not pro-life. I'm horrified by Trump and all that. But I feel like the issue that's never really addressed are the people who kind of live in the gray area where I believe women should be able to have abortions. But I do have concerns and thoughts and worries about the kind of throwaway comment that of being horrified of a baby being terminated after 20 weeks. And to me, that does give me pause.
Yeah, I really appreciate that comment. I think that there are a lot of people who sort of have mixed feelings, and I actually think that the pro-choice movement is so welcoming of people like Tim Kaine, who in the vice presidential debate said, you know, I have my faith, and my faith gives me pause, but what I do believe is that I'm not the best person to determine this for other people. And, you know, one of the things that we know and that doctors tell us all the time is that so few women seek to terminate pregnancies after 20 weeks, and mm-hmm. that almost nobody wakes up and says, oh, no, I forgot. You know, I forgot to do this. That what they are women who have faced really difficult diagnoses after 20 weeks where their life is in danger. There's some pretty significant issues with the fetus, and that those cases are the last place we want politicians who know nothing about those individual women and the individual health consequences that they're facing interfering. Those are absolutely places. And as someone who recently was pregnant and had all sorts of scares along the way, although so gratefully gave birth to healthy children. You know, when I was scared, I didn't want Donald Trump actually in the exam room with me. I wanted my doctor walking me through what are we seeing, what does it mean, what are the best medical decisions in this situation. And in those tiny portion of cases where that happens later in pregnancy, they're really medically complicated. And we absolutely don't want politicians who know nothing about those individual medical cases interfering.
Tara, did she convince you of anything?
Yes, I guess it's just more when I hear about it talked on the radio, you know, on NPR, that I always feel like there's kind of a our way or the highway, and not necessarily people saying that to me directly, but that I just don't hear the middle ground. And I do appreciate it that it's a very small amount, but, you know, I've seen many ultrasounds at five months, and I guess at that point I can't really get on board with it not being a living thing, you know, just by seeing the little baby. So, but like I said, of course, when she says that, no, you don't want starting to tear down the wall and slowly getting to the overall sense of Roe versus Wade. But I do wish that more people would talk about the gray area, because I know a lot of people who do have thoughts about that.
Tara, thank you so much. We really appreciate your call and your thoughts. As we begin to run out of time, how concerned are you that Mike Pence will play an activist role as vice president? We know that he's been one of the most anti-abortion rights governors in the nation, if not the most, and signed that bill that would have done things had a court not stopped it, like prevent abortions for the reason of fetal abnormalities, no matter how extreme, and require funerals for fetuses after abortions in some cases. He might be able to get the Republican Congress to pass things like that, even though I don't think they've gone that far in congressional bills, even with the Republican House and Senate. How concerned are you about that, or do you think that in the new context of vice president, this is just not going to be big on his plate?
No, I actually think Mike Pence is one of those rare politicians who got into politics there, you know, because of his deeply held anti-choice, anti-LGBT, sort of normative family beliefs, and that his track record as governor shows, and as a congressman, shows as much, right? That's where he spends his time. It's where he's focused his energy. He has either attempted to or been successful at passing some of the very most extreme laws in those arenas in both of his capacities. I am really concerned. I mean, this is, you know, during the campaign, news leaked that Trump was actually kind of peddling the vice presidential seat as the most powerful vice president in the history because he apparently did not have that much interest in running the day-to-day business. So I think Mike Pence, as one of the most anti-women politicians in the country, will have disproportionate impact, not only on the priorities domestically and maybe internationally, although I think Trump has more interest there, of the executive branch, but he is so connected to so many of the GOP congressmen and senators that he'll play a very big role in day-to-day activities. And, you know, I think we'll start to see that as soon as they reconvene.
Elise Hoag, president of NARAL Pro-Choice America, thank you for coming on with us.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.